All right, it is time for us to get started this evening. We are in Habakkuk chapter 2, and we're going to be working our way through this chapter this evening, and then finish up next week with Habakkuk 3, presuming all things go as planned. And then from there, if you want to just be thinking about it a little bit in advance, we'll be moving to Haggai after Habakkuk. So that's kind of where we're headed. Chapter 1, if you remember, is the first three-fourths of the conversation between Habakkuk and God. That is the bulk of the book of Habakkuk. It's Habakkuk's complaint about the injustice that is happening there in the land that distresses him so much, and then God's response that he's going to be solving this. He's going to be solving it by means of sending the Babylonians to overthrow the city of Jerusalem. To which Habakkuk replies, well, you know, you're God and I trust you, and whatever you do I'm sure is right. But, and there's that line in verse 13 about the wicked being swallowed up by someone who's even more wicked than they are, or the wicked swallowing up the man more righteous than he, but obviously in the context of this chapter, the point isn't that they're really righteous, but that, yeah, we're wicked, but they're worse than we are. We talked last time about whether that statement is a statement where Habakkuk is complaining, you know, they're worse than we are, or if Habakkuk is really asking the question of how is this going to go about accomplishing your greater purpose of your righteous rule being what is really governing things in the world. How is this all going to work out? And whether it's exactly one of those or some other nuance, it's hard to pin down exactly what he means by that. But obviously, it is concerning to him that this is going on. And the chapter ends, or his speech ends in the beginning of chapter 2 with him saying, I'll stand here, I'll take my watch at this watch post at this tower and look to see what God's answer to this is going to be. And that's where we left off last time. And then the beginning of this chapter, really all of this chapter, is God's reply. The beginning of it in particular is God's reply to Habakkuk's second complaint, which then leads into a lengthier discussion on what's going to be the fate of the Babylonians. So that's what we'll be working our way through this evening. And then the book will close. We'll talk about next week with Habakkuk's final response to all of this, which is his prayer in chapter 3. So that's kind of where we're headed, where we've been and where we're headed. Let's begin, though, with a word of prayer this evening. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for the day that you've given us, for the opportunity that we have to come together as your people and spend time together as we study your word. We're thankful that you know all and that you control all, and that whether or not we can comprehend what you're doing, that history is working its way forward to your purposes being accomplished. And we put our trust in you that all will be done in the ways that are best for us, for humankind, and ultimately for your glory. Be with us and strengthen our faith as we live in such a crooked and perverse world. In your Son we pray. Amen. All right. So, as I said, this chapter begins with God's second reply, and you could say the entire chapter is built out of this, but really the first few verses are the focal point of God's reply to Habakkuk, and that expands into a series of taunts against the Babylonians for, I think it's five different things in particular that he's going to enumerate woes upon them. And so really the bulk of the specific reply to Habakkuk is here at the outset. And so verses 2 through 5, "The Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as and collects as his own all peoples. All right. So let's talk about this. We'll start kind of big picture and then narrow it a little bit and then talk about some of the details in this that are a little bit odd perhaps, or perhaps a little bit more obscure, and try to make some sense of that. So the basic point of this reply, I think, is pretty well clear. The basic point is that nothing has changed since the first time I talked to you, Habakkuk. What I said was going to happen, it's still going to happen. The vision is awaiting its appointed time. It's hastening to the end. This thing that I said was going to happen is, in fact, going to happen. And that's the basic thrust of all of this. And even if it seems like it's going to take a long time, it's still going to happen. And so that's what you need to understand first and foremost. But notice also in that basic picture that it raises something of an interesting question, because it will be awaiting and it will seem slow and it will wait, but it will surely come. And all of that seems to indicate that this is going to take a while before all of this happens. And so that raises the question of, wait a second, when is Habakkuk doing this? Because basically everyone who has ever studied Habakkuk, as far back as I've ever been able to find, is saying that Habakkuk is late Judean monarchy, where they're about to fall to the Babylonians, and this is all going to happen really soon. And so why is it now that this is going to take such a long time for all of this to happen here in God's reply? Well, I think this is our first hint that there is more going on than just Jerusalem being punished. And you have to remember in the broader context of what God tells His people pretty consistently in the Bible, that when His people are punished, they're being punished for their own good. They're being punished to bring them to a point of salvation again. They're being punished to purify the evil and straighten out their lives and put them back on the right track. And so the Babylonian defeat of Jerusalem wasn't for the sake of the Babylonian defeat of Jerusalem. It was for, ultimately, the remnant to return. And so what is this vision that's going to seem to take so long in Habakkuk? Well, it's not necessarily, it's going to be another, 80 years before Nebuchadnezzar shows up and destroys your city and tears down your temple. No, that's probably not what's going on, but it's going to be a while before what they're doing is going to have its ultimate fruition, which is the remnant returning and all of the promises of restoration that go along with those kinds of things. And if Habakkuk's concern is not just, in the very beginning, if Habakkuk's concern is not just, oh, there's violence and that's evil and that's terrible, but if his concern is, where is God's righteous reign? How is He allowing this to happen? If 1:13 that we talked about already isn't just, that's not fair, but how is this going to accomplish your purpose of righteousness in the land? And you bring it into that, Levitical and Deuteronomical context of the punishment not being for the sake of the punishment, but to correct His people. You bring it into what's going to come later, but God would know this already, of course. The context of Daniel, where the succession of world governments that God is in control of, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of man, He's foreseeing the fall of the Babylonians, even in the very beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. You put all of this together, and I think the point becomes not just that the vision is true in that Jerusalem will fall to Babylon, but that this is a part of God's larger purpose. And that purpose is ultimately for God to be known throughout the whole earth for who He is. That is God's righteous reign being accomplished. Notice, if we can get ahead of ourselves for a moment here, down in verse 14 of this chapter, "For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." This is ultimately what God's purpose is, and Babylon's destruction of Jerusalem and destruction of the temple and overthrow of His own people are for that ultimate end. And what that means then, practically speaking, although it is implicit, what that means is that Babylon is ultimately going to fall and God's people are ultimately going to be restored, and that's the part that's going to take a while. It's not that, you know, Habakkuk is prophesying 100 years sooner than we thought he was, but probably the way I read this is that there's so much more going on than just Nebuchadnezzar destroys Jerusalem. That's the beginning of a long series of things that God is working out for His purposes, which is His glory being known. And that part might take a while, but you don't have to worry about that because, you know, God's going to accomplish His purposes. And here I think it's implicit. You bring into the context of the rest of this chapter where, you know, verses 6 through 20 is basically Babylon's going to fall, Babylon's going to fall, Babylon's going to fall. And that, I think, helps inform that particular reading of this section of the chapter as well. So that's how I read this for what it's worth in terms of the big picture of this. One, what I said was going to happen. And two, it might take a while for it to happen, but what that means is not just the fall of Jerusalem, but everything that's a part of what God is trying to accomplish in the fall of Jerusalem may take a while for all of that to happen. So let me stop for a second because that may be, that may be worth talking about or asking questions about, making accusations about. Anything here before we move on to some of the details in this section of the text? Yeah, Guy. I don't think so. We're going to come to that in just a minute. I think he's beginning to talk about the Babylonians there already in verse 5. But yeah, we'll come to that. It's a good question. That is a really interesting thing. Is it's pretty ambiguous who the he is there. And in a couple of places, who is he talking about? I'll tell you why I think it's Babylon in a second. Any other questions here? All right, well, let's get into some of those details then in this. In verse 2, Habakkuk's one of the prophets that is told explicitly to write something down. That's not always the case. Whether they were, you know, immediately writing things down or not, we don't know unless the text tells us. Obviously, the messages were all ultimately written down. But you wonder how many of these prophets were just out preaching because God called them to preach, never realizing that, you know, their writings were going to be, you know, inscribed and kept for thousands of years after them and read by millions of people. But Habakkuk, at least, is one who is told to write these things down, and he's told to write them down on tablets, which is an interesting detail here, and I don't know if it's a significant detail or not, but it might be significant in the context of what else is being said here about it awaiting and it not being slow. It might seem slow, but it's not really slow, and wait for it and all of that, because you talk about something that has durability. You've got a piece of papyrus or a piece of stone or clay tablet. One of those is going to last longer than the other one will. And so that may fit into this picture as well, as you are writing this down on something that is more permanent, because the ultimate fulfillment of what's all going on might seem slow, which is to say it's not going to happen immediately on a human timeline. And so it needs to be able to last longer. That may be what's going on there, but it's kind of hard to pin that down exactly. Something else that's ambiguous before we even get to verse 5 is there in verse 2, right at the end of verse 2, so he may run who reads it. Who is this guy and why is he running? And there are two basic approaches, at least that I've come across. One is the person who hears of the report of the violent judgment that's coming and is trying to flee. You get the news so you can flee. It's kind of like Jesus talking about in his foretelling of the destruction of Jerusalem. You hear this news, get out of town. So it could refer to something like that, although there doesn't really seem to be that kind of concern in the Old Testament for the people being able to flee town. They're all basically judged and destroyed, even the righteous people with the rest of them there. Some of them live, obviously, but there isn't that, here's your warning and your chance and your signal so you can get out of town. So that doesn't really seem to fit. The other possibility is that this is for the purpose of a herald of this message. Someone sees the message and he runs and proclaims the message from place to place. And that would fit at least the idea of something that seems to be taking a long time for it to happen. People have had time to forget about it, and someone sees this tablet and gets the information anew, and then they run out with this message. That may be the idea, but again, it's just really hard to pin down exactly what's being talked about in that line. What is more, I think, obvious in this section of text is that all of this is happening on God's timeline, not a human timeline. It's going to happen in its appointed time, the text tells us. It's kind of like the final judgment, which this is a foreshadowing of. It's a type of that. All of these kind of day of the Lord moments where God judges a nation is a foreshadowing of the final judgment. It tells us something about the final judgment, and that's going to be the culmination of all of it. But it's like that in that it's on entirely on God's timeline, not our timeline. It's like that in the sense that it might seem slow, but in reality it's hastening to its end. And that's an interesting word there, and I don't know how much to make of this sort of thing. And you always hesitate to make too much, especially if you've heard preachers make too much of words. But the word hasten here in verse 3 hastens to its end, whatever your translation may say specifically there. That word means something like puffs or pants. And it's the image you get from something panting, of course, is exhaustion. And so, you know, you imagine a sprinter headed toward the finish line sort of thing. It's rushing to its conclusion is kind of the imagery of that word, perhaps. The point of it, of course, is that God's purpose can't be thwarted. It's speeding toward its completion. And one of the things that is true here and in many other places as well is that in spite of what we say about history repeating itself, and I know what we mean when we say that, and so don't take issue with me saying that's not true, because I know what we mean. There are certainly these echoes, and people are destined to do the same stupid things if they don't learn from their past, and all those kinds of things. But in spite of what we say about history being cyclical, it's really linear. And what I mean when I say that is that it's not this endless cycle of futility, but that it's working toward a predetermined end. It is progressing along a line that God is in control of. There was a beginning point, and there's an ending point, and there are various points in between, and we are moving along that line, and there is nothing that's going to get us off of that line. And so, again, I know what we mean when we say history repeats itself, but in reality, history is linear, not cyclical, because God is in charge of it, and it's working toward a purpose. And along those lines, then, as well, even those things that might seem contrary to God's purposes serve to work out his purposes. You know, what purpose could there possibly be in his chosen people being destroyed? That seems to be like a giant step backward, right? No, really, that's a step forward in what God's trying to accomplish. What purpose could there possibly be in God's Messiah and his son being crucified? That seems like a really massive step backward, right? Well, no, that's a massive step forward is what that is. And so, again, we can't judge by human standards and human eyes or on a human timeline. The bottom line is that whatever you think about whether it will or will not happen, or when it will or will not happen, or how fast or slow it might seem, the bottom line is it's going to happen and God is in control. That's the same thing Peter says in 2 Peter 3 about not considering God's promises to be coming slowly. God is being patient. God is trying to get everyone to repent, but God is working out his purposes and his timeline as he sees fit, and nothing's going to change any of those things. Well, let's get down to verses 4 and 5, and this is the question of who this he is. His soul is puffed up, it is not upright within him. Wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as white as Sheol. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. And so who is this he? And I think this is our beginning of focusing on the Babylonian Empire and what's going to happen to them as a result, or in the final analysis or something, whatever I'm trying to say, what's ultimately going to happen to them. And the two clues, I think, three clues. One is where the entire rest of the chapter goes after this, I think is something that in context suggests that he's at least possibly transitioning to that already. But beyond that, the two of the things that we see about him, one is his soul being puffed up there in verse 4, which brings to mind verse 11 of chapter 1, "Then they sweep like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God." The arrogance of the Babylonians, that they have deified their own strength, it comes back up again here, that they being puffed up. But then also, in verse 5, he gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples there in verse 5. Jump back up to chapter 1 and verse 15. Actually, verse 14 for context. "You, that is God, make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He, that is the Babylonians, brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net," them being all the nations, all the peoples. And so here when we get to verse 5 of chapter 2, gathering for himself all nations is a callback to what the Babylonians are doing at the end of chapter 1 there. And so this is, I think, kind of our second clue, a bit clearer this time, that this vision here in chapter 2 isn't just about Jerusalem being destroyed, but it's about God's greater purposes being worked out, including ultimately Babylon's fall. And by contrast to all of that then in verse 4, "But the righteous shall live by his faith." And so here is the way for survival. And that's the point of live in this context. It's not live in the sense of how you live your life. You live by faith, not by sight, as we would, you know, perhaps interpret. We walk by faith and not by sight. But here it's Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. Babylon is going to be destroyed. There's going to be death in Jerusalem and death in Babylon, and life is found in faith. And so the righteous one shall survive because of his faith is really the basic idea there. In contrast to the wicked of Jerusalem who will die, in contrast to the arrogant Babylonians who will fall, life is found in the faith, the faithfulness of the one who trusts in God. And now, there are two different interpretations of this as well, which are, I think, are both noteworthy. One is his own faith, as some translations render it, but there's textual variance there as to whether it should be his own faith or he shall live by his faith or just he will live by faith. The question is it his own faith because he trusts in God he will live, or is it God's faithfulness to him? He will live because of God's faithfulness, because God is true to his covenant. And what I would say about that ultimately is I don't know that we need to distinguish between the two. I think they go hand in hand. The person who is trusting in God's trustworthiness is the person who is safest of anyone. It is absolutely true that it is in trusting God that you find life. And it is absolutely true that it is because of God's trustworthiness to his promises that we can find life. And so I don't know that we need to hash all this out and say Habakkuk must be talking about one and not the other, because those two things are so interwoven with one another that one's really, I don't know that one is ever present without the other one being present anyway. So, but just to think about that from the two sides of the humankind's faithfulness or trust in God and God's faithfulness or trustworthiness that he can always be counted on to do what he said he would do. One last thing here about this section, and then we'll move on to the rest of the chapter, which is a whole lot easier, I think, in terms of the details. Either that or I just skip more of them, I'm not sure which, is in verse 5. "Moreover, wine is a traitor." Does anyone have anything different than wine there in your text? I know some of you probably have a footnote at least. Wealth, okay, yeah. So wine is a traitor or wealth is a traitor is the question there. And what it amounts to is the Hebrew text says wine, the Dead Sea Scrolls text says wealth. And which one is it? And again, I don't know that there's a huge point of distinction. I mean, obviously they're different things. But I think you can make an argument for either one. A good argument from wealth is the fact that he immediately talks about greed in this next verse. So you've got a contextual argument for wealth here in this same context. And so the idea would be you're trusting in the things that you have accumulated. You're trusting in your power and all of those kinds of things. And that's going to backfire on you. It's going to betray you, whatever else the case may be. But I think there's a broader prophetic context that could allow for it to be wine, which again is what our basic Hebrew texts say. So consider, for example, Jeremiah chapter 25 and verse 15. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, to me, take from my hand this cup of the wine of wrath and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. And so the cup of God's wrath there in Jeremiah, which is again roughly contemporary with Habakkuk, the cup is a cup of wine of God's wrath. Jeremiah 51, Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand. Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand, making all the earth drunk, and the nations drank of her wine. Therefore the nations went mad. Psalm 75 and verse 8, in the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs. And so the question is it their ill-gotten wealth that's lying to them and they will fall, or is it that they're going to drink from the cup of God's judgment? Again, the specifics I don't think are overly important. The point is the same either way. They're going to fall. But that's at least how to make sense of that textual difference if you're seeing that from one translation to another, or the footnote and saying, what on earth is going on here? These are two very different things, wine and wealth. Either one you can make a decent argument for. But so that's verses 2 through 5. How do we take that much time on those three verses? Four verses, inclusive. Any thoughts, questions about any of that before we move on? Yeah, Martha? Yeah. Right, and that certainly fits in with that. I gotta stop hitting the microphone. That idea of greed there in that same verse, the covetousness in general, that happiness is always just over the horizon of the next thing that you get until you get that, and then it's over the horizen of the next one that you get, and on it goes forever. All right, well, verses 6 through 20 then narrows the focus to a series of taunts against the Babylonians in particular. And I use that word in particular because in verse 6 it says, shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say woe to him? And then it goes on from there. And so this idea of a taunt, it's an interesting sort of thing, because this kind of woe language shows up quite frequently in funeral dirges. I mean, we're familiar with it in the Bible, in prophecies against the nations, but it shows up very frequently in funeral dirges. It's a very sad sort of thing. But where it shows up in the Bible quite frequently, it's not about anything that anyone would be sad about at all. Listen, no one... I know this is not a proper thing to say in 21st century America, but there was no one in the world that was sad when Babylon fell. There was no one in the world that was sad when Assyria fell. There was no one that was sad when Persia fell. Everyone celebrated when those awful nations died, and their awful leaders died, and the awful things that they did stopped. Everyone was happy about that. And so for them to sing a funeral dirge about the impending fall of Babylon, it's what we would call sarcasm. Here's our very, very sad, sad funeral dirge about Babylon falling, when everyone knows that they would be thrilled about that day. And so this woe language that you find, it's quite frequently being more ironic than we would ever realize, just from the text itself in the Bible. And so this turning to specifically pronounce judgments on Babylon for her specific sins is what we find. Also, we're going to find more of that kind of punishment fits the crime idea that we've seen already in Habakkuk. Here, sometimes it's more explicit, sometimes it's more implicit. A couple places it's not even emphasized, and so you can't say it's all the way through. And as Dan, I think it was, pointed out last week, it's not an exact correlation correlation. Punishment fits the crime. You know, it's very much a you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind. But in terms of the kind of punishment matching the kind of crime, there is that going on here as well. So verses 6 through 8 focus on what I'm going to call the plunderer. And each of these three-verse sections focus on a specific sin that they have committed. There's a target of the sin, a result of the punishment, and almost all of them end with a for statement, as you will see. So picking up there in the middle of verse 6 then, "Woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long, and loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the peoples shall plunder you. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them." And so the target of this, again, is the plunderer, the one who is sought gain by taking it from other people. The result of his actions is that others will plunder him in turn. And so again, it's this punishment fits the crime sort of idea, where the kind of sin that they committed is being brought back on them, because you've plundered many nations, all the remnant of the peoples will plunder you. Right before that, you will be spoil for them. Why? For the blood and violence perpetrated on others will come back on them. It's reminiscent of, it's not the exact same language, but it's reminiscent of, you know, blood crying from the earth for judgment. Because of the blood that you have shed is a lot of what's driving this. And then this is going to be the only one of these four phrases that gets repeated. It's going to come up again down in verse 17, where it's mentioned there again in connection to a different particular sin. We'll move through these relatively quickly, if for nothing else, for the sake of time. Verses 9 through 11, I'm calling this the plotter. "Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You forfeited your life, for the stone will cry out from the wall and the beam from the woodwork to respond." And so here the target is this one who is scheming to make some kind of evil profit for his own security. His goal is to be safe from all harm, living unimpeded from the worries of the world. But the result, well, you got a hint of their result, at least if you were here for our Obadiah class, when he is there in verse 9, to setting his nest on high to be safe from the reach of them. You remember in Obadiah, the Edomites up on the mountain, safe in their fortress. Even the eagles can't get up there, but God says, "I'll bring you down." They're stealing from other people to lift themselves up to a safe place. How do you suppose that's going to work out for them in this context? Well, there's nowhere that's going to... You want to talk about the long arm of the law. There is no arm that is longer than God's in terms of reaching out to punish someone for what they have done. It doesn't matter where they are, they're going to be found and brought down from that place. And so this idea of them being high and being brought low, being honored and being brought to shame, being the oppressor and becoming oppressed, there's that kind of punishment fits the crime sort of idea there. More specifically, "You have devised shame for your house," is what he tells them. But of course, that's not what they were trying to do, right? They're trying to devise the opposite of that for their house, but what in all of this that they have done, they have not found security, they found shame, and they found destruction instead in that place. Your four statement here, "The stone will cry out from the wall, the beam from the woodwork," the stolen goods themselves are the witnesses of their evil. It's like the blood crying out for judgment. Here it's the building material that you've stolen is crying out for judgment in verses 9 through 11. Verses 12 through 14 is the violent one. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, it is not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire. Nations weary themselves for nothing. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And so here the target is the one who is building up his city through injustice. Interestingly, this verse shows up almost word for word in Micah 3:10, where it is an indictment against the people of Jerusalem. That it is God's people that are doing this very thing. And now it is the Babylonians that are doing this thing. And perhaps a corollary point that you can make out of all of this is that God desires righteousness of all people. It's not just his people that he expects to be good. It's all people that he expects to be good. And it's not just other peoples that he's going to punish. It's even his own people that he's going to punish. And when the exact same indictment is made against the people of God and the pagans, and they're both equally guilty in the sight of God, I think there's a pretty good point to be made there, even if it's not the main idea here in this verse in Habakkuk. But ultimately, they're under the divine verdict for what they're doing in their violence and building up a town with blood and iniquity. The people's laboring for fire there in verse 13, I'm not entirely sure what that means. What it might mean is that they're building all of this that is destined to be burned. And so think in terms of Jesus saying, you know, don't lay up your treasures on earth because it's all going to be destroyed ultimately. Well, you're building this giant city through all of this wickedness and violence and bloodshed. And what is it going to be ultimately? It's going to be burned down. That's what it's going to be. So that might be the idea of, what's the phrase again? Laboring merely for fire is all of this evil that you're forcing on these people, all this violence you're forcing on these people, it's not even for anything that's going to last. It's just going to be destroyed as well. And so what are they trying to do? Well, they're trying to build this grand town, trying to build this great city. And in biblical context, quite frequently, trying to build a great city is less about the great city than it is about the builder who's trying to establish something of a name for himself. You think back to the Tower of Babel is kind of a classic example of that. Making a city amazing with its great building projects almost always has to do with the glory of the people that are building it, right? Nebuchadnezzar's hanging gardens, that had less to do with beautifying Babylon than it did with Nebuchadnezzar's ego. This is all ways of people trying to glorify themselves in some way. That's why they're building up these giant cities. Even in Daniel 4, Nebuchadnezzar, walking along the palace going, look at this grand, beautiful city of Babylon that I've built for myself. And that's when he's judged, right? Because it's about self-glorification is what all these building projects are all about. And that then is contrasted with verse 14, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. You're trying to glorify yourselves, but you're not going to be the one who is glorified. Instead, it is going to be God's glory that is made known to all people. And that is the flip side of what this particular evil is. Verses 15 through 17, we'll call him the exploiter. I had debaucher earlier, and that just didn't work. Although it's probably a better word for it. But verses 15 through 17, woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup is in the Lord's right hand. The cup on the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. for the blood of man and violence to the earth and to cities who dwell in them. And so the target here is the one who would shame others. And so in this particular context, what it's talking about is getting someone drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. Which, you know, if the last one made you think of the Tower of Babel, this one would make you think of the Noah story after the flood, where Noah gets drunk and Ham gazes at his father's nakedness, whatever exactly that means in that context. Now, in this context, where you get someone drunk to see them naked, probably has some sort of sexual assault sort of undertones to it, as well as, at least as we would talk about that. You know, why in culture does someone get someone else drunk in order to see them naked so they could take advantage of them is what it all boils down to. And that's probably the idea here, even though it's not stated in so many words, that that's what's going on. But that raises a really interesting question, because the target of this is not, say, King Belshazzar. The target of this is Babylon. So how does one nation sexually violate another nation? What exactly is being talked about here? And again, it's hard to say precisely what this is, but it may talk about individuals within a nation that's doing this kind of thing. You know, and if there are enough of them doing this kind of thing within the nation, kind of you think of your Sodom story where everybody is intent on wickedness. So maybe it's something like that, or maybe this is a metaphor not for something specific like that, and that's why it's not specified. You know, getting someone drunk to gaze at their nakedness, whatever undertones it might have, it doesn't come out and say anything specifically about what's going on. And maybe that's our clue that this is a metaphor for immoral and exploitative sorts of things, leading others to some sort of debauchery along those lines. And so it's taking advantage of people rather than any specific sin, maybe the idea of what's going on. And here, again, you've got another one of these, you know, the punishment fits the crime, because instead you're trying to shame them is what it amounts to, but instead you have your fill of shame instead of glory in verse 16. You have tried to get them drunk in verse 15, but the cup is in the Lord's right hand and it will come around to you. And so you're going to be forced to drink from this cup instead. The violence that you did to other nations, Lebanon is specifically named here, and I presume Lebanon is an example of one of the many nations that could have been chosen, unless they did something specifically egregious to them. But all of this violence to other nations, what you did to them is going to be done to you instead. And then you've got this kind of blood Christ from the earth sort of idea to wrap all of this up in this section. Finally, then, in verses 18 through 20 is the idolater. And each of these, I don't think I specified this earlier on, each of these points, there is a woe line in this section in particular. So in verse 6, woe to him who heaps up what is not his. In verse 9, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. Verse 12, woe to him who builds a town with blood. Verse 15, woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. And then in verse 19, woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Before that, however, there is this kind of sarcastic mockery of idolatry, the sort of thing that you find in Isaiah and Jeremiah in greater detail. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it, a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath at all in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. And so here the target, of course, is the idolater. It has this taunt against the folly of idolatry. Like I said, it's a miniature version of what Isaiah in particular does in much more detail in it's Isaiah 42 or 44, I believe, where that shows up. But I could be wrong about that because my notes are deficient. I blame the person who wrote them. But yeah, there's a much longer version of this in Isaiah. And the conclusion of all of it here, you don't have the, here's what you've done wrong, and here's the exact punishment that's going to happen. It's just the woe statement. You don't have the for statement. Instead, you have a but statement. It's a contrast. Rather than a, because of this, the judgment is coming, it is, look at the foolishness of idolatry, but God is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him. And so it's far from this frenetic activity of humankind to create gods. It's far from the absurdity, and again, you think of Elijah on Mount Carmel here, right? The absurdity of all the activity and volume and noise that is created by these worshipers trying to make their gods speak. And by contrast to that, you've got God before whom we should be silent. And so these lifeless idols that are approached in clamor are silent, while the living God, who is approached in silence and reverence, speaks to His people. And what an incredible contrast that is when it's set here as it is. This verse that we know so well from Habakkuk is not something that's standing alone. It's the conclusion of this short judgment against idolatry and taunt against idolatry. And notice also, and I'll end with this because I'm past time right now, so if you want to hit that bell one more time. Notice also that this is a universal response that is being called for. It's not Yahweh is in His holy temple, so the Jews should keep silent before Him because He's their God. Or, you know, one day the Christians should keep silent before Him because He's their God. God is not a localized pagan deity that's stuck in a geographic region. He is not just the God of His people. One of the points the Old Testament makes over and over and over and over again is that God is sovereign over all. God is in control over all, and whether or not you like it, He is your judge. And that is just hinted at yet again here in Habakkuk 2:20, let all the earth keep silence before Him. All right, I'll stop there. We'll get through chapter 3 next time.